Mr. Bill Bates, Real 3. We've just been having a look at the dates, and you think that probably you went to Royal Arthur around about September, October 43, were there till October, November 43, and then you were at Glasgow from October, November 43 through to probably as far as May 44. Because you then were only at Chatham for about a month at most, not even that. So it can only have been no more than May.
I know. I've got a very, very quick draft from Chatham to Liverpool, to the Liverpool Destroyer Depot, in fact.
So, did they still have many of the American facilities on the Goodall?
No, not really. The ice water thing didn't work. There was. None of the fineries that they had, as far as sea clothing and things were concerned.
What about the laundry? Was that still working?
The laundry, yeah, on the laundry flat that was down aft, that was working. Yes, in fact, Fred was the laundryman. But you see, there used to be all sorts of fiddles going on. It was used so much, it was very, very difficult to get your gear in there. And especially when you think that hammocks and things like that and blankets were going, about 200 men, and it all had to feed. So it was a matter of bribery or corruption or anything else to try and get your gear as clean as possible.
And would some people still use the old bucket method? Or
I did. I used, except for blankets, which had been too big. But I used the bucket method, yes.
And what about the now your job? You were an ordinary telegraphist. Mm-hmm. Was your station in the radio room, the wireless room?
Yes, it was.
Now, where exactly was that? And could you describe
it? That was just abaft and below the bridge, just behind the bridge, below one deck below.
And was that your action stations or your cruising
station?
Well,
it was
on both.
That was both, actually, but I was changed on our last trip.
And could you describe the wireless room?
Yes, it was about 20 square yards, I suppose. As you went in the door, there was lockers for parts on the left-hand side. The coding room was on the going forward on the right-hand side. Then there was a bench with three radio sets and HFDF. On the same bench, so there were three operators working there.
Now, you weren't an HFDF operator, were you?
No.
Did you know what it was?
Yes,
secret.
In fact, I've got a picture of a man here who went all through the technicalities with me. Unfortunately, he got killed. Coda Jackson. He got killed.
So you knew what it was about?
Yes, and behind us we had this massive, great transmitting set, which the first lieutenant that he killed himself on. He was a very passer, and he was a long time serving man. He was a lieutenant, and he came in.
Do you remember his name?
Yes, his name was Dalloway.
Dalloway or Dalloway?
Dalloway, Dalloway. Everything had to be just so where he was concerned, spick and span, and passer, as I say, Navy. And he came in, and the front was off the transmitting set. And there was some dust on the top cap of a valve, the transmitting valve. And he said, "Look at this dust," which he tried to wipe off with his finger. And we remember seeing a large flash go between his feet. So he wasn't so clever next time he came in. But he was a good seaman. That was amazing.
Now, what you've got all this equipment in there. What did you actually operate?
I operated the Shipshore and CCM, it was a confidential coded machine.
Tell me about the Shipshore one first.
Well, that was both combined, in fact. That came mainly from Admiralty in Liverpool, a Lava building in Liverpool, which gave us directions and news about submarines and U-boats and so on and so forth. It was all in code, five-figure code.
And could you read that code?
Yes. I mean, I read it and put it on signal pad, and then it was given to the coder who put it on the machine, the CCM machine.
And the CCM, you told me, that's the...
Confidential coding machine.
And could you work that?
No. Well, I suppose I could have done if I had the... what happened is they changed the reels in the machine every day according to the day and time. And the rest of it was just like a typewriter. In fact, you could use it as a typewriter, which I did on one or two occasions.
And these messages, so that you never knew what you were taking in. You were just taking in, so accuracy was very important.
Well, if you missed anything, of course, that's, you just messed up the whole message. And it could have been that U-boats were in your area. And I often thought it was ridiculous as a 17, 18-year-old listening out on that when the whole, you could have jeopardised the whole convoy. I thought it was a bit stupid. You know, just... a new man on, new boy, not man. But as far as I know, I never missed a message.
How fast was it? Was it? It was within your grasp then.
I think it was sent by teleprinter, and in because of that, it was clear. Everything was clear.
What do you mean by teleprinter? Sorry,
they would use this typewriter to send. It would be transferred into Morse. From a teleprinter, yeah. And so all the signals, all the Morse was clear, providing the atmospherics was okay. And it was at a reasonable speed, about 20s, I suppose. So it came through. It was not a bit nasty if you had bad weather conditions.
Oh, okay.
So you had to rest yourself on the bulkhead and the chair in order to hold the pad.
Now, did your wireless have a name, or was it just a Shipshaw wireless, or was it a particular mark or type?
Not that I can remember. It probably did, but I can't remember.
And there were three of these, were there?
There were three sets there. There was the CCM, which I operated. The local Shipshaw, he was a telegraphist, S special, because he could read German, and the Huff men.
So you always just used your one?
Yes.
And what about the other equipment in the wireless room? Did you ever use that?
Well, there was
a big transmitting one that they...
No, I never transmitted. That was you had to be fairly senior in order to transmit. And we weren't allowed to transmit in any case. No, let's see.
I know. Were you very aware of the wireless silence?
Sorry, the...
Wireless silence, radio silence.
Oh, yes. We knew they could pick us up quite easily, especially if we could pick them up. You know, once they'd got that coding machine off the U-boat, they could more or less pinpoint where they were. I can remember that.
Now, any other duties you had as a telegraphist, or was it just shifts on this?
It's just shifts on that.
How were the shifts operated? Was it normal watches?
Sometimes it was four on, four off, depending what the area you was in, how dangerous it was, whether there'd been any messages regarding U-boats in the area.
Did you follow the normal watch system with dog watches, or were you on...
Yes, we followed those. A normal running routine, we would follow those.
Could you explain the watch system? Because a lot of people don't understand. Again, people don't understand it.
Well, then...
As best you can.
Remember, there was the forenoon, which was 8 to 12. Afternoon was from 12 to 4. Then we had a first dog, 4 to 6. Second dog, 6 to 8. Then the middle watch. Oh, no, night watch, and then the middle watch. That was 12 to 4 in the morning.
And you followed that generally?
Oh, yes. And as I say, there was something biggish on, and then we would operate in a different way.
What would you do then?
Well, the...
One action station. That would be action
station.
What was your action station?
Well, originally it was in the wireless office. It got changed later on to our emergency wireless office, wireless position midships.
What was different?
Well, there's a little cubby hole, about 3 foot square, and in there was a radio transmitter and receiver.
And that's later on, though?
That was later
on. Yeah. We'll say that, because that, would that be where you were when the good old got sunk?
Yeah, I got locked in there, in fact.
Right, we'll come to that later, then. Basically, your duties were on watch.
On watch, yes.
And you'd be on. Now, when you were off duty, what would you do?
Well, if you were cook of the mess, so you used to take turns each in being cook of the mess. You would prepare the meals, take them to the galley to be cooked.
Now, what sort of meals would you prepare? What were you good at? What could you do?
I was good at nothing, actually. I tried to make things like spotted dick and all that sort of thing. It was a hopeless mess, so they gave me mostly the cleaning to do. And they would, somebody else would knock up the food, you know, get the food ready. I'm peeling spuds and things like that.
So you prepare it in your mess?
You prepare it in your mess and then take it to the galley and it would be cooked. Then you go and collect it. We were lucky because we were inboard, so we didn't have to run along open deck with high seas running with a fanny full of food. And if it got wet, the rest of the boys got very annoyed.
And any other things you'd do when you were off duty?
Well, there never seemed a time when we weren't doing anything yet. I can't remember.
Would you be on sort of ordinary seamen, like things like cleaning the ship? And
We as operators, wireless operators, they're special Admiralty Fleet orders, AFOs they were called. And in there said that we mustn't do anything that might damage our hands, because obviously they would be needed for transmitting if it was necessary. So we used to get away with murder, I think. You know, we'd clean our own mess decks and bunks and tables, decks, bulkheads, goodness knows what, deckheads. And there always seems something to do.
So you clean your own mess, but outside of that?
Oh, no. Your own mess and the companionways coming down to it. And you clean the wireless office, obviously.
And what about recreations, you know, when you're just sitting there in your mess?
Next to nothing. If we're lucky, we've got a broadcast of the ship system.
What type of broadcast, sorry?
Well, mainly, I can only remember Glenn Miller music.
And this would be, how would you get that broadcast? Would that be coming from?
That'd be picked up and put over the Tannoy system.
Picked up by the what, your wireless colleagues?
Wireless colleague, yeah. And then the skipper used to run beard growing competitions.
Could you enter there?
Well, he said to me that it's just a good excuse for me not to go near a razor. I was only 17, 18. Of course, I hadn't even really started growing a beard or growing whiskers. But there was only one man who ever won it. He used to grow about 2 foot in a week, it seemed. But he would run quiz competitions over the Tannoy. Things like that.
Was it much gambling? You know.
Well, you call it tombolo. That if we were safe enough, they'd have a game of tombolo, which is bingo, modern bingo, in other words. But that was all. I didn't see a game. I know there was one on board, a gambling school, but I never saw where it was.
With Crown and Anchor and things.
I don't know what they played, to be quite honest.
You weren't interested?
I never was in cards.
How did the other men treat you? You were a fair bit younger than most. Not that much younger than some, but, I mean, you were quite pretty young. How did you get on with the other lads?
Oh, fairly well. The only time it was a bit awkward is when he went ashore, they obviously got more cash than I did. So, and I was younger and couldn't take so much beer, so I was a bit of a drag where that was concerned. But no, I got on quite well with them.
Did they keep an eye open for you?
Anything I wanted to know, they were only too willing to put themselves out and show me. I mean, I was.
And did they make sure you didn't get into trouble? I mean, you know, because, I mean, like drinking, it's quite easy to drink.
Oh, no, if you got drunk, that was you're down to your own devices. And if some big American was start on you in Lime Street, Liverpool. You're completely on your own. But, no, they were good. They were a good bunch of lads. Well, I.
Do you have any special friends amongst them? Because we've got pictures of some. You know, some of them. Which ones do you remember best?
Well, there was Fry, because when I was ill, on board, and I was seasick on my first trip. I really was bad. He gave up his bunk for me, knowing I was being sick all over the place. And he'd been in the army, and he transferred back to the navy. And he was an absolute gentleman.
Any of the others?
No, not really.
Fryer?
We used to go ashore in 3, 4, 5, a half dozen of us.
Would you tend to hang out with the there's a picture here with...
this is Blondie. Yes.
Blondie Fryer.
Yeah.
What about Wallace, Pope, Carter?
They were very gentle and timid, those two. One got married, got killed to mouth just after he got married. Just before we sailed, and he got killed. It was Ainsworth, I think. But, by the time I joined the ship, the thing was that most of them had commissioned the ship anyway, and they had their own cliques. I know you wasn't excluded from them if you wanted to go out with them, or go ashore with them, you went. But, no, I apart from Fry...
Is it Fry or Fryer?
I can't remember. Fry, I've got it in the...
It's all right. We'll sort it out later. It's but he was your main mate.
Yeah.
What did they? Did you mix with the seamen, ordinary seamen, not the and with the stokers?
Well, no. You see, the trouble with Captain Cross frigates, as they were compartmentalised. It's unusual, but the stokers were forward. We were amidships, and the seamen were aft. And they were bulkheads going right across. There were one or two doors going through. So you were completely isolated from them.
So you didn't see much of them?
You saw them as you went through to the heads, which were up in the forecastle and the showers. You went through their mess, or near their mess, and you got to know them by sight. And I mean, I know all their faces, but I couldn't tell you one of their names. And there would be some ribald comments going, because they used to call us seagoing wrens, because being in an office, out the weather and anything, and they were on the upper deck. So there was that sort of rivalry, but nothing else.
Now, what about your leading seaman? Who was that, and what was he like?
He was, we had a PO, Finn.
Sorry, Petty Officer.
Petty Officer. Yeah. Finn, we used to call him, Petty Officer. Finley, his name was.
Do you remember his first name?
No, I can't. We always called him Finn. You know?
What was he like?
He was very gentle. The most unlikely type of person to make a sailor, I think. Very knowledgeable. Approachable. He was a very nice man.
Now, which officers come to your mind?
Well, only three, really. Knocker-White.
Who was he?
He was in charge of communications.
He was so sub-lieutenant?
So I think he got his other stripe. He was lieutenant.
And he was a signals officer?
Signals officer, yeah.
And what was he like?
Well, the times we saw him, he was okay. I never had that much to do with him. When he would come in at the back and go into the coding office, he'd do all that sort of work in there, so I saw very little of him. He virtually run it, the Wallace office ran itself. There was a routine, a very set routine. And Mr. Dalloway, of course, he was...
Mr. Dalloway, you've mentioned him already.
He was first lieutenant. He was strict, passer. And got some good laughs out of him, really.
In what way? Tell us some of them.
Well, he was so passive of the Navy that everything had to be spick and span. And on just one occasion, the sort of things he would do, he decided he would paint our 3-inch guns forward a lovely brown colour that blended with the rest of the ship. And of course, it was painted brown. The first time it was fired, all the paint flew off. he was a good officer.
He was competent, was he?
Yeah, he was great. He was a competent. And yeah, he would do things like in my emergency cubbyhole course, he would leave all these paints and bits of ladders and ropes and goodness knows what. And I couldn't get in there. It was emergency Wallace office. I couldn't get in there.
And what about the captain? Who was that?
That was Fulton, his name was.
Captain?
Fulton. F-O-U-L-T-O-N. Lieutenant Commander.
And what was he like?
Well, we very seldom saw him. He was a big man, stocky. We knew he was... had a steel mills up in Scotland somewhere. He was a good skipper at sea, not a very good one for manoeuvring in harbour. He seemed always to get it wrong.
I've heard that before. In what way?
Well, if that's, say, the Mersey, in order to get into Gladstone Dock, you had to go up, turn, and then come into the Gladstone Dock itself, and that was a difficult manoeuvre. And 9 times out of 10, he would give us a bump.
Did it damage the ship much?
Well, on one occasion it did. It made a big dent, and the engineer took us down, and all he did was put his foot on the side of the bulkhead and give it a push, and it went out like he would with a car if it had a bump. They were welded ships, as you know, and they were that sort of pliable.
What did you think of the welded? I mean, you were a new sailor. Did you and the rest of the group, what did people think about the welded, all welded construction?
Well, I think I took it as it was no different to any other ship. But there were some comments passed that it would never hold up, and we had one particular stoker, coder rather, who had been on some nasty convoys, and he said he was always afraid that if we were attacked by the Luftwaffe, the bullets would go straight through, you know, and he'd had one or two experiences of that. And he wasn't all that keen, but I don't think many people... The only thing was, when you came in, if you'd had a rough sea, there would be lots of welding and unbuckling to do. Such as the breakwaters amidships, they always used to seem to break off or buckle.
Now, what about Gladstone Dock? What was that like itself? I mean, before we go on to the voyages.
It's hive of industry, actually. You couldn't step anywhere other than over ropes or wires or loads of oil all over the place. Everything seemed to be in a complete shambles. Yeah, it seemed to work. As soon as you went in, the wrens would come aboard doing welding and bits of maintenance and so on and so forth. The dockyard mates were swarming all over the ship. And next to no time, you'd be turned around ready to go.
Would you get ashore in Liverpool much?
I used to go to Litherland. I found...
To where?
Litherland, which is outside Liverpool, just outside Liverpool.
Why there?
Well, there was a local town hall that used to run dances and had films and bits and pieces like that. So... I preferred to go there rather than into the main town.
Why was that there? What was wrong with the main town? Because they must have had dances and things. Was it rougher? Or?
Well, yeah, it wasn't so sort of personal as that. I've been in quite a number of times into Liverpool, Lime Street, up and down there, but it seemed more, I don't know, brash or whatever it was. Litherland was a little bit out in the sticks, as it were, on the suburbs. And... I found it very pleasant there.
So what was the first job you remember going out with, getting back into the chronological thing?
I think the patrols, Southern Ireland. And then from there, I really can't remember.
What were the patrols off Southern Ireland like?
It used to be pretty rough weather around that way.
Off Northern Ireland, it says here, but would that be it?
Yeah.
How bad was the weather? Let's talk about your seasickness. Well, you've already said you were. How bad was it?
On my first trip, I prayed and prayed and prayed to die, because I was so ill. I'd always been a very bad traveller, right from a kid, and boy, I couldn't travel on buses, trains or anything, and I was so ill that I just prayed and prayed to die. But I'm proud to say I did keep my watches. I managed that. I had a bucket between my knees, pencil in one hand and a mop in the other. I did manage to keep, which I must say Mr. Dalloway thanked me for. The first trip was a pretty rough one. I think somebody said it was one of the worst storms they've known in the Atlantic.
What about the rolling? Because they were famous for rolling. How bad was it?
I had no experience at all. And when somebody told me at the Liverpool Destroyer Depot, when they knew I was going aboard Goodall, that she, I'll use their expression, can I, because it's a slightly bad word in it. She rolls like a turd in the Thames. That's how I described it. And they really did. I think we did about a 43-degree roll from port to starboard in about 4 seconds on one occasion. The inclinometer or something on the breeze, so I don't know much about that. But that was the sort of thing that was normal. I mean, she'd roll a pitch and toss even in harbour. They were infamous for that.
Now, the next operation you didn't meet any submarines. On that trip. The next one would be you escorted Highland Princess to Iceland.
Yeah, if I remember rightly.
You seem to have done that a couple of times. You took the Otranto a bit later. But
yeah, they were fetching the army boys at on leave and taking them there. I believe that's what it was for anyway.
What were those trips like to Iceland? Anything?
They were pretty mundane. It was not too much to them. We've got this, obviously, we've got the scares over CCM where U-boat packs were, or our special operator would hear them broadcasting to one another, especially if there was a large convoy around. And on one occasion, I believe, although I'm not quite sure about this, there was a ferry that was sunk quite close to Ireland and had women and children on board, I believe. I know we stopped ship in order to see if we could hear anybody calling out, and that was fairly eerie. To just stay there motionless, just rocking back and forward, listening.
But that was off Ireland?
Iceland.
Off Iceland? Mm. But you didn't hear anything?
No.
And then the next thing, you joined the Vindex, which crops up again, I know, the aircraft carrier, on operations north and west of Scotland. I don't know anything about that. Do you know anything about that?
Well, yeah, they were just playing, but because they started to fly over the Atlantic, didn't they? And then they introduced these Woolworth carriers, as they were known to us anyway. It gave us a bit of air cover. The Vindex and our group worked quite often together, in fact. But the same is, it's more or less that you went to sea, you didn't know what part of the ocean you was in any case, so you wouldn't know which direction to swim if you got sunk.
This is why, I mean, I've got a nice list here that's taken off official documents, yeah. But you wouldn't know what.
We wouldn't know, no. We didn't land anyway. We did about 5 weeks at sea, something like that. We'd see land once in a while. We knew we'd been somewhere, but we didn't know where.
So this was operations with the Vindex, and then north of, again to Iceland. Nothing much happening in this period.
No, I think we was only allowed one shore.
How many messages?
Well, I'm going to say we got plenty of pings. Not always successful. Got contacts.
What would happen when you got? What was the procedure when you got a contact?
Well, for the first few seconds, that's absolute pandemonium. But we got to our action stations. I should imagine in less than half a minute we were closed up, ready. Then our skipper wasn't one for broadcasting, to tell the crew what was happening. The first we'd know is if they were going to drop a pattern or use a hedgehog, and he would tell us then, but other than that, he didn't keep you abreast of what was going on all the time. As far as I was concerned, I was listening to CCM, so I had a pair of earphones on, and I couldn't hear what was going on anyway, so it's the most impotent feeling you can imagine, just sitting there reading CCM. It might have been, something to do with Wren's underclothing, or it could be that another U-boat was on its way, or a pack was on its way to meet us. I didn't know what it was all about. Then, the coding office would do that.
So, Did you drop many depth charges and hedgehog on these alarms, or would they not come to that? Or they
quite quite a number of times, yeah. And they started dropping these ton charges, the big ones, the really big boys, and that shook the whole ship. And the trouble was, you.